another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. A quick update on the recent call that we had for volunteers, and I did that both here in the podcast and on the forums. The response has been nothing short of outstanding. In fact, it's been actually much, much better than we had hoped for in a best-case scenario. The number of volunteers really has been nothing short of overwhelming, and we're still sorting through all the responses now. So if you have volunteered and you haven't heard back from us, we are getting back to you, and it isn't just me actually. Depending on what you volunteered for, someone else may be getting back to you if they're the ones that we've kind of delegated that responsibility to. The number of Linux answers and articles and original content that you see on the site should just skyrocket in the next week or so. And actually, some articles have already been submitted. I think a couple people may have already been writing stuff kind of for themselves and then just volunteered it to be posted here at LQ. If you are interested in doing something and you haven't responded yet, or you have a specific skill that you think would benefit us that we just didn't underline in that call for help, please do not hesitate to contact us. We are still looking for help in a variety of areas, and you know, we want as many people as possibly want to participate to be able to participate. So, like I said, do contact us. Next up, LQ is sponsoring the upcoming OSBC. The OSBC is the Open Source Business Conference, and it's going to be held in San Francisco on February 14th and 15th. Here's a little blurb. The Open Source Business Conference is the industry's top forum where business leaders, attorneys, and VCs, which are venture capitalists, gather to discuss and drive the latest innovations in the open source industry. Get a head start on your strategy. Know what your customers and competitors are doing before you read about it. And as a sponsor, I'm happy to be able to offer any podcast listener or LQ member the ability to get 34% off of a registration to the OSBC. And the code that you're going to need for that is N0307. Now, I'll post that in the forum also, but 30% is a substantial discount, and like I said, that is open to any LQ listener. So I haven't been able to attend the recent OSBC conferences, but I have heard very good things about them, and this continues what really has been an outstanding relationship between LQ and IDG. We're not only sponsors of the OSBC, but we're also, of course, sponsors and very oftentimes participants in the Linux World Expos, which is another IDG event. Like I said, I haven't been able to attend them. I do actually hope to attend this one. It is just about a month away, and it is, as you heard, in San Francisco, which is clear across the country for me, but I am going to try to make it there. So if you will be attending and you'd like to meet up and talk about stuff, don't hesitate to contact me. Next, I had mentioned that I'd highlight a couple of new features of the LQ code upgrade in each podcast. I'm going to select two for this podcast. First, each member now has their own blog, and I think that's a great way for LQ members to talk about stuff that may be Linux or maybe even not Linux related, but isn't something that would necessarily go well in the forums. And this should help build the sense of community and let LQ members get to know a little bit more about each other. One note on this feature is that there is a small bug in the way that the blog sometimes outputs, but we should have that fixed up ASAP, and it doesn't prevent you from entering content or others from seeing the content, so do feel free to get started with that right away. The easiest way to access that is if you click My Blog in the My LQ nav on the right-hand side of the site. The second feature I'd like to highlight is the ability to use zero replies as a search quantifier for any arbitrary search. And really what this means is that you can search for any topic that you feel you have expertise in and then help with the zero reply threads. And helping with zero reply threads really is a fantastic way to help not only LQ, but your fellow LQ members. Making sure that absolutely as many questions can get answered do get answered, I think really is essential for the success of LQ. So this is really, I think, one of my favorite new features of the site. The last LQ-related story I have for you is that I wanted to give everyone a reminder that the drive to 3,000 LQ Wiki articles continues. The current count as of right now is 2,640, so we do continue to make good progress. Contributing to the LQ Wiki is a great way to share your knowledge with the Linux community. And due to the licensing on the LQ Wiki, which you can choose as either GFDL or the default of Creative Commons, ensures that all the content entered into the wiki will remain free forever. Participating in the wiki couldn't be easier. Pretty much all you need is a username, and then from there you can create new articles, edit other articles, and we've noticed a big upswing in participation in the wiki since our recent call for help, or call for volunteers. One great thing here is that you don't need to necessarily be a Linux expert, or I guess better put, you definitely don't need to be a Linux expert to really be able to benefit the LQ Wiki. You can, if you have knowledge in a specific area, you can edit or add articles in that area. But even say you're just good with the English language and you don't know a lot about Linux, you're still very beneficial to go through existing articles and correct the grammar or correct spelling mistakes, things like that. Or let's say your area of expertise is that you really like wikis and you know how to, you know, quote-unquote, wikify something, but you don't know anything about Linux. You can go through the articles and make sure that the output on them looks better, things like that. So anyone who's interested should head over to wiki.linuxquestions.org and jump right in. Now on to the news. First article I have is, what do the Hotmail admins think of the Windows GUI? And this is based on an article that appeared in acmq.com. Here's a little snippet from the article, which is an interview, and I'm just going to select one question answer. The question was, are there scaling reasons to think about the benefits of a command line for managing over a GUI, or are there other things to think about? And the answer was, our operations group never wants to rely on any sort of user interface. Everything has to be scriptable and run from some sort of command line. That's the only way you're going to be able to execute scripts and gather the results over thousands of machines. And that's the end quote. Really, I don't know how Windows administrators consistently deal with the limitations of the Windows GUI. And as the lead on the Hotmail, which does use Windows now, and I don't know if some of you may remember a while back, and this is probably going back about 4 or 5 years, they did try to switch Hotmail, which had been running FreeBSD, to Windows, and it turned into a complete disaster. I'm not sure exactly when they changed, but they did finally change to an all-Windows setup now. So while a GUI may be fine, and obviously even preferred in a desktop environment, a GUI in the server environment, in my opinion, is nothing short of crippling. And I think that for a variety of reasons. You know, the lack of easy scripting, which is what, you know, they mentioned, the limitation of only being able to access features that are exposed via the GUI is a huge one. A lot of the things, to take kind of a direct correlation to something that would be applicable to this article, some of the things you can do with scripting and accessing features via Apache that are kind of outside of what you could do in a GUI are critical, and things that we even do at LQ. Not only that, the added overhead of actually running the GUI on the server is just something that isn't needed, and when you're trying to eke that last bit of performance out of a machine, the GUI can be something that's absolutely make or break. Even looking at Windows GUIs, which tend to be lighter, I think, than the Windows GUI, something like KDE or GNOME take a huge amount of resources. But even one of the lighter ones, let's say you go with Fluxbox or something like that, the RAM and CPU used to actually run that GUI would be much better served, in my opinion, in a server going directly towards MySQL or Apache or whatever that server is meant to do. So the list goes on and on. That's just a few examples, but I think you get the general gist of it, and I could probably go on for quite a while, so I'll stop there. Another thing I found interesting is that there's kind of an illusion or insinuation that there some customizations were needed in parts of the Windows stack to get Hotmail to be able to scale as far as it did. Now, of course, the only way that you're ever going to get access to the Windows source code is if you're part of Microsoft, which 99.99% of the world is not part of Microsoft. But Hotmail, of course, is, being part of the MSN group. So having that access allowed them to scale as far as they did, which is something that you or I would just simply not be able to do. So there is one of the great things about open source is 100% of the world has access to that code. If there's something that doesn't scale or doesn't do what you need it to do, you can do it. You know, the ability to scratch your own itch in the end is something that I'd personally never want to be without, and especially if I was in an environment that was so conducive to itching as I think Windows is. The next story I have is the first draft of GPL version 3 has been released. So the first draft of the GPL version 3 was recently released. I was able to find an HTML diff of version 2 versus version 3 on the web, and I did link to that on my blog. I thought that was extremely useful just for getting a quick idea of what has changed. And there are some sections that have gone significant changes. There are other sections that remain virtually unchanged. So the first disclaimer I want to give here is that I am not a lawyer, and the GPL contains a ton of legalese. So these are my interpretations and what I think of it. If you are using the GPL in a business setting, I do recommend that you actually get a lawyer versed in these things who will be able to tell you how it will play out in a court, which is something that I definitely cannot tell you. So, of course, a legal document that hopes to stand up in court actually does have to be written in this type of language, in this kind of legalese. But the human readable version of the Creative Commons licenses is something that I've always really, really liked. And my first kind of foray into Creative Commons was when I chose it as the default license for the LQ Wiki. And they have what's called the human readable version, which is a very succinct, very plain English explanation of here is what this license means. This is the rights that it gives. This is just how everything plays out. Now, of course, they also have the longer legalese version for lawyers, but it gives the average person the ability to see what that legalese means while keeping the full version, you know, like I said, for lawyers and judges. So a cursory glance at GPL version 3, and I did notice a couple of very valuable additions. One that has kind of gotten a lot of scrutiny and has been posted to a myriad of news sites is the anti-DRM clause. And it's under the, quote, licensing of patents, end quote, section. And it's something that has got a lot of people on both sides arguing back and forth. The anti-DRM clause is something I'd like to take a closer look at, and it's probably something you'll see me cover in more depth in the next podcast. Another thing that I think really is going to help is this version seems to have slightly more hope of being compatible with other open source licenses, and that is very, very welcome. The fact that so many open source licenses are not in any way compatible, I think is a big barrier and a big hurdle for us. The one thing that I didn't see but expected to see was a clarification on how the proliferation of web services impacts the GPL. Here's a quick explanation of what I mean by that. There's a lot of cases where someone takes a GPL program, for sake of argument, let's say PHPBB. They then edit the source and then only offer it as a web service. So they're not offering the download of their modified source, they're not offering it as binaries, they're only offering it as a web service. So you could go to that PHPBB forum and post. Now, are they required under the GPL to release their modifications? And that has been just a huge question that I've never seen legally answered under the last version. And like I said, it was something I thought would be answered in this version. I don't see it addressed in any way, but if someone with more legal knowledge does see that, please do drop me a line and I'd like to chat about it. The one thing that I've always found interesting about version 3 of the GPL is that the Linux kernel itself, which is arguably the largest GPL project or most popular, will probably never ever use it. The kernel includes this in its source, and this is from copying. Quote, "Also note that the only valid version of the GPL as far as the kernel is concerned is this particular version of the license. That is, version 2, not version 2.2 or version 3.x or whatever, unless explicitly otherwise stated." End quote. So it's my understanding that what that means is that anyone who has ever contributed code is doing so only specifically under version 2 of the GPL. So, moving to version 3 or any other version would require every person who has ever submitted any code or patch or anything to agree to that change, which seems like an insurmountable barrier to me. Another thing, the GPL has an auto-upgrade clause in version 2, which I've always found extremely odd. Now, I can see how it would be useful, You always get the latest and greatest version of the GPL without too much hassle. But what if the latest version contains a clause you would not have released your source code under? And that's the problem I see. I've never seen a good answer to that one either. The last story I have is cracking Dell's code. A recent VAR Business article asks if, quote, shifting market conditions, poor business decisions, and lagging technology are creating fissures in the direct sales giant and creating opportunities for solution providers, end quote. So this article really looks at and details the reasons why Dell is going to find the future road ahead tough. Things like reluctance to push an aggressive blade server strategy, lack of high-end servers, and a quick side note here, I didn't realize how lacking Dell was in the high end. They had only 5 server sales of servers priced over $25,000 in this third quarter, at 5. And they don't have a single 8-way or more server in its product line offering at all. And if you compare this with some of the other vendors like HP or IBM, they sell literally thousands of servers over $25,000 a quarter, and most of them have 32-way machines. So the fact that Quad is Dell's biggest offering means it's severely, severely lacking. And the last thing the article touched on as a reason was its commitment to Intel only, which is missing out completely on the Opteron. Now what I have to wonder, and what was not mentioned at all in the article, is how has Dell's on and off again relationship with Linux and really open source in general impacted their sales? The Dell server line with Linux would have sold quite well in my opinion, and they're a very good fit together. Dell kind of took commoditization up a notch in the PC market, much like Linux did in the OS market, so I always thought that they had kind of a synergy there that Dell just kind of dropped the ball on. On the desktop side, having a cheap, say $400 or so Dell desktop with Linux also would have been huge, especially in the business market. You know, I don't think that Linux on the desktop for the consumer is quite there yet, but there's a lot of businesses who would have definitely ordered hundreds, if not thousands, of Linux desktops supported by Dell. So by offering A, only Windows, and B, only Windows on Intel, Dell really forced a lot of companies to have to choose multiple vendors to either get their AMD processors or to get their non-Windows machines. When you take into account the quality of Dell's server offering, I think the fact that Dell forced people to have multiple servers in their server room, that direct comparison that Dell created there, surely led to a decrease in Dell server sales. I really do believe that. Making you buy either, you know, a Sun or one of the higher-end servers and seeing really the difference that is there could only be a bad thing for Dell. Now on the desktop side, and this is really where they slipped the most from a revenue and profit perspective, offering Linux would have given them a growth potential in a place where they're not seeing growth, so it clearly would have helped. And I still don't know why, shortly after his nice and wonderful Linux World keynote speech years ago, Dell suddenly and inexplicably cut their Linux desktop offering to nil. Their decision to be so schizo on the topic, however, certainly hurt their revenue, which means it certainly hurt their bottom line, which means it certainly hurt their shareholders. Now, that's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.